Good morning. Welcome to Meet the Author. Denny Griffin here, and I'll be your host for the next half hour. And my guest today, I believe, is on the line right now. Let me check. Well, it appears she's there. I just can't seem to pick up the call. There we go. Are you there?
Yes, Denny. Hi, how are you?
Good morning. We almost had a technical glitch here. hold on just a second. Let me back up and finish the introduction, okay?
All right.
Okay, my guest this morning is Rita Sciano, and she's a freelance writer and author. Her novel, Painting the Invisible Man, explores the complex dynamics of growing up in an Italian family on the fringes of the mafia. Good morning, Rita.
Good morning, Denny.
And welcome, and I got to tell you right up front that your subject matter is right up my alley.
I bet it is.
I'm really into the organized crime stuff. So could you start out by giving us a little bit of background, more background about yourself and your book?
Oh, certainly. I grew up in upstate New York, and I saw in reading about you that you were in law enforcement in New York State. So I was almost wondering if this the actual crime event was something you were familiar with. But as I said, I grew up in Syracuse, New York. I now live in Massachusetts. And about 6 years ago, 2001, I was researching the archives of the Syracuse Post-Standard, my old hometown newspaper. I was looking for some information for one of my clients, and I made a keying error. And in the course of researching through those archives, I typed in my father's name, and 37 articles came up that referenced him, all from the 1990s. And the one, Denny, that caught my attention said that there were the FBI had audio tapes of a mob enforcer talking about a 20-year-old murder that he got away with. And that 20-year-old murder was the murder of my father in 1976. So that sent me on quite a journey to try and understand. I was 21 years old when my dad died. So there was a lot that I really didn't know. And he was someone who was in and out of my life. And I never quite understood what he did. I just knew that he was very different from any of my friends' fathers.
So you started based on this rather an accidental stumbling onto the information, right? Then that's what prompted the book.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I literally made a keying error. Instead of charging one article to my card, I charged 10. So, you know, I don't know if you've ever made a keying error and try to correct a credit card online. It's more of a hassle. So I got I retrieved the article from my client, and then, you know, I had 9 more, and I was just typing in names. And why I typed his name, Denny, at that time, I just don't know. But I, in retrospect, I think it was to explore this story.
Let me just, before we go further, if anybody would like to call in with a question or comment, you can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. And in a little while, I'll ask Rita to give her contact information, any website or email information she'd like to give out. So if anyone might be interested in contacting Rita or learning more about her or her books, if you have a paper and pencil handy, we'll give out the information in a few minutes. Rita, so what did you learn? We probably don't have enough time for you to tell me all this, but as you started then getting into the research and really getting into this thing, about your dad and so on. Did you come across anything that was surprising to you, anything concrete, anything that you thought helped you understand more about your father and what happened to him?
Yes, I did. I mean, I was able to talk with the defense attorney. I was able to talk with the prosecutor from the Organized Crime Task Force. So I learned a lot of details of, what led up to that event. And, I mean, certainly the man that was acquitted of the murder, who was the man on those tapes, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that he was guilty. But there were also a number of other characters, men that, you know, I had known as a young child that were really, you know, pretty unsavory men in the work that they did, and some of them hiding behind reputations of very well-known and prominent lawyers. but who the who a lot of their clients were really were mob connected. No, yeah, I wanted to ask you, Denny. I saw that you were in law enforcement in New York State. What area of New York?
Well, I started out as a deputy sheriff in Madison County, which is neighbors Onondaga,
okay,
Syracuse, and I was there in the early 80s. Then from there, I got a job at the state level as a healthcare fraud task force investigator, and I worked statewide after that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you might be too young to remember this, but in Syracuse, I believe it was 93 or 94, the Onondaga County medical examiner was named Eric Mitchell.
Yes.
You recall him?
Yes.
Well, I got involved as the chief investigator investigating the medical examiner's office and Dr. Mitchell. And he was allegedly doing some things, keeping bodies that should have been cremated and so forth. So that was quite a lengthy investigation. I was assigned to work out of Syracuse during that period. And my first book, I fictionalized the investigation, called it The Morgue. I set it in Utica, but that's where that story came from. It was actually based on the Mitchell case in Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite interesting. And I don't know, just so I was still living in Verona, New York at the time, but working out of Albany. It was a rather bizarre setup. But so I knew, even though I was no longer in law enforcement in Madison County, I did keep my finger on the pulse, so it's possible that I've heard of some of the incidents. Or
oh, I bet if I gave you some of these names, you would know this cast of characters.
Now, if you want to, email me sometime with the information.
I will do that. I will do that. I mean, certainly the attorney, the defense attorney, was a man named Jim McGraw, who he was the one that ended up defending Lee Alexander, the mayor of Syracuse.
Mayor Alexander.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, it was Jim McGraw who was his attorney, and he was also the defense attorney who defended the man that was on trial for the murder of my dad. And the interesting another interesting twist of fate in this whole story is several years later, Jim ended up marrying my cousin.
Is that right?
And became part of my family.
Oh, my goodness.
So, in the exploration of this story, I had to deal with not only trying to understand who my dad was and, you know, what were the circumstances that led up to his death, but come to understand my role, myself, in relation to so many of the people, like in relation to Jim, and just even looking at myself as a young child, at age 10 and 11, I did some pretty strange things. I used to carry this rubber pellet gun in a holster underneath my school jacket. I had smoke bombs and things sewn into the seams of the vest. And I used to do all of these things to take pictures of everybody, detail anybody I saw that looked very unsavory around me. And not understanding as a child why I behaved in that way. But it certainly was because, as you know, in retrospect and through the writing, I realized that as a child, I didn't feel safe and didn't quite understand why, because I didn't really know my father's world.
So you learned a lot about yourself as part of this then?
Absolutely.
So it was beneficial. Was it therapeutic, actually, to help you understand why you did some of the things?
It was, Denny. I mean, it was absolutely freeing.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you researching before you actually got your manuscript completed? How big a project was it?
I took between when I found the articles in 2001, I didn't really start working on the book until almost the end of 2004, because I couldn't make peace in my mind about really wanting to explore the story. And I knew that I was going to have to learn details about my dad, about his death that, I didn't want to know. I mean, after he was murdered, I mean, it was big headlines in Syracuse. All the headlines were, Shiano gangland-style murder. So it wasn't like it was something that was unknown. But the thing that always troubled me was, what was it like for him in those last moments of his life? Because he was picked up in Syracuse and then driven about 30, 40 miles outside the city and, left, taken out of the car on a country road and shot dead and left, you know, his body just left there on a country road, you know, in the middle of the night. And I always, you know, it was very torturing to wonder what was that like, that last 30, 40 minutes of his life. You know, how tormented was he by, you know, by the man or men that were in the car. And, you know, in researching the story, and it had so much press coverage through both trials. There were two trials. The first one was a hung jury, and then the second one was an acquittal. And, you know, there was an FBI informant who had tapes of, you know, the man that was on trial for the murder talking in great detail about what happened in that car. So learning that and was very, very tough. So I needed to really get my, you know, wrap my head and my emotions around it. And once I did that, it took me about 2 years to complete the project.
Did you get any support in your project from other family members? Or, I mean, did the rest of the family know what you were doing, and did you have their support in what you were doing?
The only family member who knew what I was doing was my cousin Terry, the one who's married to Jim McGraw. She's the only one. No one else. My mother is deceased. My brother, I didn't tell him about it until the manuscript was done and actually about ready to go to press. and I sent it to him because, you know, I didn't know how my brother would react, because, you know, as it came out in the trial, had he followed my father home that night, which, you know, they ran this little gambling casino in Syracuse, and usually at the end of the night, my brother would follow our father home because my father left with all this cash, but that particular night he didn't. And he took a right-hand turn, my father took a left-hand turn, and my father was stopped like two blocks away. And what came out in the trial, that had John been there, he most likely would have been murdered that same night. It was the plan.
So both of them were going to get it.
Yes.
Let me ask you this. Do you recall, was there a specific reason that you remember for the hung jury or the acquittal? What would cause the jurors to not convict?
Well, you know, the attorney was able to convince them because a lot of the testimony rested on this FBI informant, and you know, he had been in and out of jail. I mean, he was really not a very good witness, and plus they touted out a nun who claimed that she talked to the man on the phone that night. And, I mean, there was just a lot of testimony that, you know, the attorney was able to just put forward. But I think the key thing was that the FBI informant just was not credible enough.
And
you know, it was one of those old Nagra tape recorders, you know, that was mounted inside the dashboard of the car. So,
yeah,
you know, the quality at times was just so poor. So he could just raise a lot of, you know, a lot of doubt, a lot of reasonable doubt, and that's what a case like that rests on, is if there's reasonable doubt, you must acquit.
So some of the evidence was not high-tech from those days.
Oh, no, we're talking 1977.
Yeah. So what was your brother's reaction when you sent him the manuscript? Was he on board with you or no?
He was supportive of me. I mean, he admitted that it was very difficult for him to read because, you know, it brought back so much. And the brother character in the story is that, you know, as I told you, I did write this as a contemporary historical fiction, you know, meaning that it's based in fact, but it has a fictional setting and a fictional names to the characters. So, you know, I was able to, you know, I needed to be able to merge my imagination with my memory to really recreate some scenes. So I didn't feel that it would have been honest to have portrayed the story as a memoir or a nonfiction. So I went that route. And in the book, in the story, the brother character takes his own life. And that at first bothered my brother. You know, he's like, why'd you have to kill me off? And, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, because quite frankly, you know, metaphorically, you have died since Dad's death. And he admitted that, you know, he sees his life as before, you know, AD and BD, you know, before Dad and after Dad. I mean, that's the way he put it to me. There's BD and AD. And so I said, so what made, you know, in order to really tell the story and not to get into where you are now and what's happened to you now, it really was the best way to deal with it. Oh, and he was not happy I had his character drive a Corvair. He said he would never drive a Corvair.
That was insulting, huh?
And, you know, and having, you know, the way siblings can get along, I was not about to change that.
Okay. Listen, let's take a second before I forget. And would you like to give out any information for people could get more about, learn more about you or your books, or contact you with a question?
Sure. They can contact me at my website, which is www.ritashiano.com. And to get the book and find out more, read more of the information behind the book, they can go to www.paintingtheinvisibleman, the title of the book, www.paintingtheinvisibleman.com.
Okay. Now, as you just mentioned, you fictionalized the story. Did you ever consider doing it as a nonfiction? Did that ever enter into your mind?
I did at first, and that was my first approach. But I found that, you know, there were a couple of things. I knew that I had to rely on some memories going back to when I was 10 years old. So, you know, I had to go back 40 years in my memory bank. And I knew to recreate some scenes, I was recreating them. I couldn't say that this was, you know, verbatim the conversations that were have or exactly where they were. And, you know, after the whole James Fry debacle with, you know, his book, A Million Little Pieces, the last thing I ever wanted was someone to come back at me and say what you did was disingenuous.
Yeah.
So knowing that I could not accurately, you know, portray what happened 40 years ago in my life and detail that. And plus I found, too, that when I was taking a more journalistic approach to the writing, it was really lacking in emotion. And one of my friends that I gave the manuscript to about the first 70 pages, you know, I gave it to her to read, and I said, tell me what you think. And she said, well, the writing is good, but the heart is missing from the story. So once I was able to just step back in that fictional mode, you know, I like to say it's very similar to what Truman Capote did with In Cold Blood, or Meyer Levin with the book Compulsion about the Leopold and Loeb trials. You know, they gave, especially Meyer Levin, he put it in, he created it as a fiction. And actually that was the start of that whole genre, contemporary historical fiction. Just to be able to recreate scenes that you knew you couldn't point to in fact.
You know, I found with my stuff, I started out writing fiction and switched to nonfiction, but there's a whole bunch of issues that come up when you decide to do a nonfiction. And there's so much more you got to be careful, because you're right. All you had to do, if your memory was faulty, not that anything intentional,
mm-hmm.
but if your memory is a little faulty in a fact and you're promoting the book as a nonfiction, and somebody picks up on one little detail that isn't quite right and it's documented somehow, your entire credibility can go down the tubes. And once people
Absolutely.
Doubt you, once they think... you know, well, this wasn't accurate. How much more is inaccurate? So it is a very difficult thing, and you really got to be on your game to go that route, you know.
And that's why I made the decision, too. Actually, I was doing a book discussion and a book signing at a library in Brookfield, Massachusetts last night, and one of the people there said, you know, if you wrote it as a fiction, what made you decide to go out and talk about the facts of the story and the truth behind the story? And I said, you know, it really took me a while to decide to do that. But I feel that what is equally as compelling, I mean, the novel on its own, if you read it just as a fiction, I think holds up very well. You know, I think it's a strongly written book. The characters are very believable. The dialogue, the setting, everything works. But because the story behind it is real, I felt that I would have been equally disingenuous to not have admitted it, to
right.
said, oh, yes, this is all from my imagination.
Yeah. And that's working for you, that approach.
Absolutely.
And you're
Absolutely.
Comfortable with it, doing it that way.
Yes, I mean, I have a couple guidelines that I put out. I will not speak the names of the actual people that were the criminals in the case. You know, I'll mention Jim. I'll mention, you know, Don Kinsella, who was the prosecutor for the Organized Crime Task Force. But who Angelo Caprero is and who Joey Casella is, I will not speak their names or give them to the press.
Did you happen to keep tabs on these people? What happened to them after the acquittal and so forth? Are they still around, or do you ever hear of them?
Yeah, the Angelo Caprero character did end up going to jail on an arson. He served a good amount of time for an arson, and interestingly, when he got out, he contacted my brother. My brother lives just outside Las Vegas, and I was visiting him last year. And he was telling me that when the man got out, we'll just call him Angelo, which is the character's name in the book, he called him and wanted to meet him. And, you know, John said, I'll meet you, but I'll meet you in a public place. And he really was wondering what it was all about. And, I mean, this is how crazy this guy is. He wanted to know if my brother would cut him in on a portion of his card game. Here, he's taking our father's life.
Talk about brass ones, huh?
Yeah, and could he cut him in on a card game and lend him $100?
Oh, my word.
But he passed away in the latter part of 2004, which also was another reason I put off the writing of that book. However, the Joey Casella character is still very much alive, and as I've discovered in the writing of the book, was equally as frightful man, and someone that I had known since I was a little girl, and you know, write about that very honestly in the book. I mean, he was probably my first crush. You know, when a little girl makes that move from, you know, your dad being your whole world, and suddenly there's somebody else, and here was this man that was a friend of my father's that I just had the biggest crush on as a kid. And turns out, in everything that I've come to learn about the case, he probably was the person that put out the contract.
Wow, something. How do you feel about him now? Do you have any thoughts, emotions?
I've come to peace with it. I guess that's the best way that I can say it is, you know, I've made my peace with it and addressed it in the story, and don't want to give too much of that away because it really is another point of the story that really is kind of compelling.
Okay.
And if anyone was to read the book, I don't want to give that away, but I
sure.
have made my peace with him.
Good.
In my soul.
Good. Let's get back now, you finished the manuscript, now you have to have a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
What steps did you go through to find a publisher?
Yeah. Oh, I did the whole query letter process over and over and over and over, and I couldn't get anyone to read the manuscript. I finally did find one publisher who said, yes, we take the manuscript, we need 6 months, we read it, you know, front to back, and we'll get back to you. So I sent it to this company and, you know, spent $38 getting the manuscript photocopied, you know, the $8 to mail it, the $8 to have it sent back to me if that's the case.
Yeah.
And it literally arrived on my doorstep 8 days after I mailed it with this dirty photocopy of a form letter that said, oh, dear writer, thank you so much for sending the manuscript. We went, you know, we read through the whole thing and blah, blah, blah. And I'm looking at it, Denny, and I'm thinking, well, there looks like there's like a thumb smudge print on the title page, but the remaining 300 and some odd pages were as crisp and clean as the day I picked them up at Staples. So I was pretty frustrated.
You have
and
a suspicion
I,
that maybe they weren't telling you the truth.
Oh. And I came pretty close to putting the whole thing in the shredder that night. I was just so frustrated. But then I stepped back from it, and I had a conversation with a woman that I had done some editing for. I'd worked with her on the structuring of her novel, and she had been for 3 years, you know, just the same thing. Couldn't get anybody to take a look at it. And I called her up and said, you know, would you meet me for lunch? She lives about 30, 40 miles from me. So we met halfway, and her name is Janina Chung, and I said, you know what? I got a proposition for you. In the 1980s, I lived in New York City, and I was a vice president of a publishing company, so I understood the business. I said, I'm thinking of forming my own independent publishing house, and if I do, would you sign with me as an author? And I said, and this isn't like, you know, publish, you know, Lulu.com or any of those. You know, you're not paying the bill. I'm paying the bill. You get a standard author contract. You get royalties. But, you know, and your book goes to press. It's not going to be a print on demand. I'm doing it the traditional right way. I said, and you'll be the second book that I publish. I'm going to publish my book first and let that be the seed money to keep the company going. So that's what I did. I formed my own publishing company. I publish two authors a year. I look for new, exciting, good talent. You know, the people that can't get someone to read their manuscript.
So
that's what I did.
Your website, people could learn how to make submissions and so forth?
Yes. The publishing company is, if I could say that, please, Denny, it's www.reededwards. That's R-E-E-D. Edwards, EDWARDS.com, readedwards.com. And there's a submission page, and we do ask that manuscripts are sent, and we read them.
Good. That's a good thing to hear, that somebody actually looks.
So, you know, I have proofreaders and editors and great graphic designer. I mean, anybody that looks at the cover of Painting the Invisible Man, I mean, it's just a stunning book cover. And actually, Janina's book, the woman that I met with last year and, you know, made the proposition to, we go to press with that in 2 weeks.
Wow. Did you have any special genre you're after? Is it, do you open to anything? Or?
I would like to stay with contemporary historical fiction. I will entertain some memoirs and biography and nonfiction.
Okay, and read, R-E-E-D, Edwards.com.
Yes.
Okay. If you don't object, I'll send that out to my writers' groups I belong to.
That'd be terrific.
Of course, I don't want to see you get, you know, thousands of manuscripts.
Hey, if in the thousands I find that one really good writer, I'll be thrilled.
Okay, I will get the word out on that. We're running out of time very quickly. I would like to just touch base with you on marketing and promotion. I think, and since you're a publisher, we'll get your take on this, that the author has to be prepared to do the lion's share of their marketing, that most publishers, even the big houses, aren't spending a whole lot of money sending every author on a worldwide book tour. And do you agree with that, or do you...
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, as I said, in when I was in New York in the 80s, I worked for a publishing company, and especially there, we used to publish 60 to 80 books a year. And, you know, there's only so much marketing dollars. You know, a book gets its life and then it's backlisted. Mm-hmm. And my first novel came was with a independent press, a company out of New York called Rising Tide Press. And I found, too, with that, you know, there's only so much marketing money they're going to spend, and then it goes on to the next book. So, yes, any author needs to do the lion's share of the work. You need to make the connections. And I mean, the internet, Denny, I have found that since in the time between the two books came out, the internet has helped so much, getting on online reading groups like Shelfari and Goodreads. And, you know, if you get people there that will review your book and talk about your book, the blog talk radio shows have been great. And you know, I do. I'm dogged about it. I mean, I'm doing what I call a regional tour right now that I've worked very hard on getting it within New England and New York. And I'll go to the I like the independent bookstore. Independent bookstores are great. They really work very hard to get people in for your book discussions and your book signings. Libraries are great to go to. Almost every library has a book reading group or a book club. So those are great to go after. You know, the Barnes & Nobles and the Borders are okay. Well, Borders we got to think about now because who knows what's going to happen with those stores. But the Barnes & Nobles that I've done, you know, they don't always give, if you're an unknown author, a lot of attention. You know, they'll tend to stick you at a table in the back of the store or something.
Nobody knows who you are or why you're there.
But the independent bookstores and the libraries are great to go to, and I really recommend that people do that. And you know, I hope more writers look at the small independent press, because these are people who are really committed to publishing authors, not to taking their money and making them pay for it. I really object to those self-published companies that just
radio.
Take a lot of money and, you know, and charge authors, you know, three times over. They're almost better to start their own.
We ran out of time. The live stream has been cut off. However,
okay.
What we're saying now will be in the archive. Okay?
All right.
I just wanted to ask you, do you get to Vegas periodically, right?
Yes, I do.
Because there's a new independent bookstore that's open here called Cheesecake and Crime. They specialize in mysteries. And sometime when you're in town, maybe I could introduce you if we're here at the same time, and they would probably carry your books and maybe schedule you for an event.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, I'm probably going to be out visiting my brother over the next few months. So I will definitely do that, and I will look you up, Denny. I would love to sit and have a cup of coffee with you.
And please don't forget to send me that information to see if I recognize any of the stuff.
Okay.
From the old days there.
I will do that. Denny, thank you so much for having me on your show today. And I really enjoy listening to your Las Vegas mob show every week.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for being with me, Reed. I really enjoy talking with you. And best of luck to you.
Thank you, Denny. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, thanks to Rita Shiano for joining me today. Very interesting interview with her. And we'll see you again on the next Meet the Author show. Thank you, and have a good day. Bye-bye.